name is Deborah James, and I'm the director of the International Program at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. CEPR was established in 1999 to promote democratic debate about the most important economic and social issues that affect people's lives. We've done extensive work on domestic issues, including Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid, labor unionization, work supports, and the housing bubble, as well as international issues, including trade, the IMF and the World Bank, and economic growth in Latin America. We put this event together on very short notice, realizing that there was a gap in the debate happening right now in the United States that CEPR seemed particularly qualified to fill. There's an emerging consensus that the recent crisis in the global financial markets can largely be attributed to a lack of appropriate oversight and regulation, including the accumulation of more than $8 trillion housing bubble in the United States. The bailout for Wall Street approved last week in the U.S. Congress does not include remedies for preventing another similar crisis. The financial crisis of 2008 is likely to be, for the Washington consensus, what the fall of the Berlin Wall was for communism. Then we read the managing director of the International Monetary Fund, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, offering to coordinate the global reform process, which could begin next month when finance ministers and central bankers convene in Washington for the annual IMF World Bank meetings on October 11th to 13th. This is because, according to Strauss-Kahn, the, and this is a quote, IMF is the right place to organize a global response to weaknesses in the global financial system. Today, economists Dean Baker and Mark Weisbrot will discuss the current economic crisis and consider the choice of the IMF as a future global finance regulator. Dean Baker was the first economist in the country to warn about the dangers of the $8 trillion housing bubble, and he urged the Federal Reserve Board to take steps to rein in the bubble before it grew to such dangerous proportions. While most other economists expressed surprise at the current crisis, Dean warned years ago that the collapse of the housing bubble would inevitably lead to a recession and a financial crisis. He's also been a prominent critic of the bailout package. He's author of numerous research papers and articles on the housing bubble and the credit crisis, many of which are available on the table outside, and all of which are available on CEPR's website, cepr.net. Economist Mark Weisbrot has written numerous research papers and articles on the International Monetary Fund's recommended macroeconomic policies in developing countries over the past decade. His criticisms of the fund's policy advice have been joined increasingly by world leaders, most recently at the General Assembly of the United Nations in September, where the IMF policy advice was contrasted with the massive provision of liquidity and record-breaking nationalizations taken by the U.S. government in recent months. Well, you've all been hearing a lot in the past weeks about these issues, ideas, analysis, and proposed solutions, mostly from the people who got it wrong over all of these years. So today, we're very excited to bring you two of the people who have in recent years gotten all of this very much right. So with that, I'd like to give Dean Baker the floor. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, getting it right in D.C. is probably a handicap, so don't hold that against me. I'll go through four parts. I won't talk that long, but four parts to it. First, I want to say a little bit about the economic crisis. You know, where are we? What got us here? Secondly, talk a bit about the Paulson plan. Then the third thing, I want to say a little bit about the marketing pitch. We really had an extraordinary marketing pitch for that plan, something the likes of which I've never seen, at least not in my lifetime. And lastly, just a sort of mini forecast where I think we're going, you know, what the immediate issues are going forward with the economy. So starting with point one, it's remarkable to me, you know, even as we've had this housing crash, you know, I was out there flapping my arms about the bubble, people not taking me seriously. I'm used to that. You know, I've been talking about this for a long time. People were saying, oh, no, there's no big deal. I debated, by the way, the chief economist from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac several times. And whenever I said that there are going to be real serious problems, they just go, you're being ridiculous. I'm trying to see if I could find those guys. I think they're both unemployed. But you know, it's the real story here is the housing bubble front and center. And I think it's still striking to me that even after the crash, even after we've seen house prices fall by some measure, 20% in nominal terms, close to 30% adjusting for inflation, you still have a lot of people are talking about this and they don't recognize it was a housing bubble. They talk about the mortgages. We had crazy mortgages. We had all these people with, you know, subprime mortgages that there was no way on earth they'd be able to pay off. They were adjustable rates. They could pay the teaser rate. They couldn't pay the adjusted rate. They had bought homes with no money down. They had cases that most of you have probably heard now about a ninja loan, no income, no job, no assets. You know, I mean, exploding arms, that was the other great term. You know, this was widely known, and that was part of the story. But what underlie that was, of course, the bubble. I mean, no one, you know, in ordinary times, banks don't deliberately make loans to people who can't pay them off. Go to your banker, tell them I want to borrow money, I can't pay it off. They aren't likely to make you a loan. The reason why they were willing to do it in 2004, 2005, 2006 was it didn't matter. As long as house prices are going up 10, 15, 20% a year, it doesn't matter if you're lying about every single thing down there. They couldn't care less. Maybe you never worked a day in your life. You don't have a penny to your name. What? Why on earth would they care? They're lending you money on a home that's selling for $200,000 today, and in 2 years it's going to sell for $250,000, in 4 years it's going to sell for $300,000. If you don't make the payments, they take the home back. They're going to sell it. You know, they don't care. So what was really front and center there was the bubble. You know, the second part of the story, the crazy leverage that you had, you know, Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns leveraging themselves to the hilt. Again, that amplified the problem. That made it a much bigger problem. Fannie and Freddie, I should say, you know, they were probably the worst in terms of leverage. But, you know, what really got them in problem, again, was the housing bubble. You know, particularly Fannie and Freddie, you could be very, very heavily leveraged in prime mortgages, because prime mortgages don't generally go bad. And when they do, you know, these are mortgages you put, you know, 20% down or got mortgage insurance on. Think of, you know, what the way things used to work 10 years ago. You're not going to take a big loss on it. You know, most of that's going to be covered. So what really mattered here was that house prices went through the roof here. By this measure, they rose by more than 80% in inflation-adjusted terms, and they've now fallen about halfway back. So really what's front and center was the housing bubble. And it's important to recognize that because, well, I'll come back to this in a second, but that really was at the core of our problem. We had a bubble-driven economy, and that was what should have been addressed front and center. Now, I'll just quickly say, we could talk more about it later, but, you know, what could have been done? Well, what I always say, what the most obvious thing that Alan Greenspan's villain number one in my story, and I'm glad other people are now seeing him that way as well, what could have been done, first and foremost, was Alan Greenspan could have talked about it. Economists like to poo-poo talk, but I always say, you know, there's a, you know, you all know the line, talk is cheap, so, you know, what would have been the harm? And I don't mean muttering, you know, under his breath, irrational exuberance, as Greenspan did back in 96 about the stock bubble. I mean, coming out with charts, with papers, showing the data. I had this. I would have gladly shared it with Greenspan if he couldn't get his Fed economist to do it, which, of course, he could. And pointing out that there is no bubble. And, you know, the reason why I was so confident saying that there was a bubble was because I went around, you know, harassing people and going, tell me why I'm wrong. You know, and there was no one, and this was back in 02 when I first started raising the issue, and it just got worse and worse, 03, 04, 05, and 06. There was no plausible explanation for this 80% run-up in house prices. And I have government data that goes back to 1950. Robert Shiller from Yale University constructed the data going back to 1895, where it shows from 1895 to 1995, we have a 100-year-long trend where house prices just kept pace with inflation. You got a 100-year-long trend, house prices are just even with inflation. Suddenly you have house prices rise by 80%. No one has a plausible explanation for it. I don't think it takes a lot of creativity to say you have a bubble. Okay, now the last point, if anyone doubted, the other line you have here is rents. Rents aren't going anywhere. Now, we have a single housing market. Rents and house sale prices don't move together, but they move more or less in the same direction for the obvious reason that people have a choice between renting and owning. People aren't going to sell their house and, you know, move across the street to a rental just because, you know, they think the price is too high. But over time, people do move. You know, kids form their own households. They move into an area. People from other areas move into an area. And if house sale prices are hugely out of line with rents, they're going to opt to rent rather than own. So if there was something fundamental in the housing market that was driving up prices like that, it should have shown up in both rental prices and ownership prices, and obviously it didn't. This is real, real simple stuff. You know, you can try and make them very complicated, but the basic story was incredibly simple, and it was absolutely, you know, incredible negligence on Greenspan's part, the Fed's part, not to have recognized it, not to try and do something about it. Now, again, as I say, I think talk would have done it. I think had Greenspan used his congressional testimonies and said, you know, instead of telling people to go out and buy a home, as he did, or get adjustable rate mortgages as he did, don't worry, there's no bubble as he did, if he instead said, I am very concerned that there is a serious housing bubble here, people are going to lose a lot of money in their homes. The people lending money are going to lose a lot of homes. The people buying securitized mortgages are going to lose a lot of homes. Had Alan Greenspan said that, that would have put the fear of God into a lot of people. It's very hard for me to believe that wouldn't have had an impact. And again, as I've always said, talk is cheap. Go ahead and do it. If it doesn't have an impact, fine. You'd take second steps. Other steps he could have taken, the bad mortgages that were going on, this was no secret. A lot of us were talking about this, you know, 2004, 2005, 2006. The ninja loans were widely known. There's no way on earth that Alan Greenspan didn't know that there were junk loans being made all over the country. He chose to ignore it. They had the regulatory authority to crack down on that. And they since actually used it. They've set up guidelines this year, 2008, talk about, you know, closing the door after the horses have left, you know. But, you know, they opted not to do that, and, you know, to my mind, as I say, that was absolutely criminal. Last point on that is, obviously, they could have raised interest rates. I don't like to raise interest rates. I think, you know, it slows down the economy, deliberately throws people out of work. As a general rule, I would not advocate that, but given the choice, if the Fed had used its other tools, if Greenspan had done everything he could by trying to scare people to death about the bubble, if he had used his regulatory powers to the full his full ability, and you still had this bubble going, I would raise interest rates, because the damage from the bubble is so extreme, particularly a housing bubble, that you would have been better off slowing the economy, trying to have a controlled recession than the sort of uncontrolled crash that we're seeing now. So that's sort of the quick story on, you know, the housing bubble. Let me go through some of the ramifications here. The basic story of the housing bubble, on the one hand, obviously, you had the housing market go through its roof. We had near record rates of housing construction over the years 2002 to 2006. It expanded from its normal share of GDP over the post-war period about 4% to being about 6% of the economy, so about 50% larger than its normal share. That was a very big stimulus. But the other part of the story was that we had a huge amount of consumption based on the housing bubble. And this is actually the bigger part of the story, because people were spending based on their consumption, their housing wealth, which is a perfectly rational thing to do. You have a whole group of people around D.C. who go around ranting about how people aren't thinking about tomorrow, how they're spending rather than saving. It's actually not a stupid thing. If you see your house price go from $300,000 to $400,000 to $450,000 and everyone's telling you it's going to go to $600,000, and I mean, the experts are telling you it's going to go to six. Why bother to save? Your house is rising. You know, the house is doing it for you. It's a perfectly reasonable thing. Take a vacation, get a new car, whatever it is. You know, why would you scrimp if your house price is going up in value by, you know, by $20,000-$30,000 every year? And that was the story that people saw. That's why it was so important that Alan Greenspan attacked the bubble. People were spending money that really wasn't there. It looked like it was there, but it wasn't there. So we see that the savings rate fell under 1% in 2004, and it's been very, very close to 1% in the period since. So basically, you had a story where because of housing wealth, people were spending like crazy, and that drove the economy. Okay, so that helped boost the economy over this period, but again, it was not going to last because the bubble wealth was not going to last. Okay, the next point, you know, what happens when you have house prices are too high? I probably should just focus on one of these, but I have vacancy rates. This is called supply and demand. Economists used to believe in it. There's a lot of things that they taught us when we were in grad school they don't seem to adhere to anymore. But anyhow, the basic story here is you had vacancy rates of rental units and then ownership units rise to a record high. Vacancy rates for rental units went over 10%. Rental units can be converted to ownership units. You all have heard of condos. You know, it happens. So if you're sitting around there with a place that you're trying to rent and no one's buying it, you know, at some point you're going to look to convert it to a rental to an ownership unit. The other chart is the ownership unit chart itself. There's twice as many ownership units as rental units, and very few people can afford to carry two mortgages. The reason why I regret putting this on the same chart is that it's a little hard to see, but basically the vacancy rate on ownership units is 50% higher than any previous peak. So it hit 2.8%, I think it was at 2.9% at its peak. It had never previously been above 1.8%. Okay, and we have had housing slumps before. So we're talking about an incredible vacancy rate on ownership and rental units both. My reason for mentioning this is, one, it was one more piece of confirmation. Those who were wondering whether anything unusual was going on in the housing market, if you looked at those vacancy rates, that could have told you something. But the other thing is, there's a lot of people running around in Capitol Hill who say, oh, what we have to do is support house prices. And frankly, it's about the most harebrained idea I've ever heard of. I love to pick up the New York Times, and they go on these diatribes against farm price supports, some of which are, you know, they're right on. But, you know, everything they say about farm price supports being stupid policy, inefficient, blah, 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 multiply it by about 100. You know, if you want to have a house price support program, that's about the silliest thing I ever heard of. House prices are going to fall. If I could snap my finger and have house prices adjust tomorrow, I would do that. I can't. But, you know, I there's absolutely no public interest in trying to keep overvalued house prices. I sometimes joke about it that that would be our government's unaffordable housing program. Why would we want house prices to be too high? I just can't understand that. Okay, the last point, I'll try to walk you through this because I realize the way I did this, it isn't very clear. The real villain in this story, the underlying villain, is our trade deficit. We have a trade deficit, this is going back to 06, it was 5.7% GDP, it's a little less than that now. We have a trade deficit of 5.7% GDP, or we did, and the reason for that was the dollar. We had a high dollar, and again, this is something we used to talk about in grad school, they don't talk about it anymore, but the value of the dollar is going to determine your trade deficit. You know, sorry folks, that is what determines it. If you want a lower trade deficit, you want a lower dollar. If you want a high dollar, you want a high trade deficit. This is about as simple as it gets. The dollar determines the value, what we pay for our imports. You know, we have a lot of people run around saying, well, we have a high trade deficit because we have a budget deficit. I have never yet met a person who buys the imported good rather than the domestically produced good because we have a budget deficit. It's crazy. You buy the imported good because it's cheaper. And why is it cheaper? It's cheaper because the dollar is high. Okay, if we want people to buy the domestically produced good rather than the imported good, get the dollar down. The imported good becomes more expensive, you then buy the domestically produced good. Same thing happens overseas. We get the dollar down, all the junk we're producing, it's suddenly 10, 20, 30% cheaper in Europe and Latin America and China. It suddenly becomes more affordable. People buy more of our exports. The basic story here is you have to get the dollar down. The people who want a high dollar want a high trade deficit. They may not know that, but they do. Okay, so that's the basic story. So we go, okay, so we have this high trade deficit. Let's say we want to get something close to full employment. Well, basically, if you have a high trade deficit, an accounting identity, what that means is we're borrowing from abroad. That means we have to be saving very little here. So we have three choices. On the one hand, we could have a very large government deficit, a government deficit equal to 8% of GDP. That would get us, you know, an offsetting, I won't go through all the assumptions that get us here, that would offset a trade deficit of 5.7% of GDP with normal household savings rates. That's about 8% savings rate. That was our historic average before we got to this period. So what would a government deficit of 8% GDP be? That would be $1.2 trillion. Okay, so that would be one way to offset the trade deficit if we had normal household savings. Case two, suppose we maintain the modest budget surplus and instead we do it on, I should check my graph here. Number two is the mixed order. Let me jump to number three. Number three is suppose we do it by savings, that we run a balanced budget as many people want to do. We continue to have the trade deficit we have. We'd have to have a savings rate, household savings rate, that was equal to almost minus 4% of GDP, or as a share of household income, it would have to be a negative savings rate of about 7%. I don't think any of us want to see that. We'd have even more dissaving than we had over the last few years. And the middle one is a mix of the two, which is more or less where we've been lately, to have both very weak household savings and a very large budget deficit. But the point here that I want to draw on is simply that if you have a large trade deficit, as we've had, you have to have either a large budget deficit or very, very low savings or a mixture of the two. There is no way around it. Okay, I'll come back to that in a minute. Now let me just quickly trash the Paulson plan and then come back with my forecast. Okay, the Paulson plan, just three basic points on it. One, it was very inefficient in its design. Two, it ended up rewarding incompetence. It rewarded the people who got us here. And three, it did nothing for the homeowners, or very little for the homeowners who are affected. First off, in the design, its inefficiency, it was absolutely remarkable to me that there was this incredible consensus from left to right among economists that this is the wrong way. If you're going to do a bailout of the banks, there's some economists who didn't want to bail out the banks, but those who thought it was important to try and keep the banking system operating, the way you do it is directly through an equity infusion. You buy equity directly in the banks. You could find people at AEI, at Heritage, at Cato, you know, along with everyone to the left of that. We were all saying the same things. What is Henry Paulson proposed doing? He wants to pay too much for bad assets. you know, that gives them capital. I mean, we buy $700 billion of assets. We pay $700 billion for assets that are worth $350 billion. That's like giving them $350 billion capital. But the alternative was we could have just given them $700 billion capital. Or if we just want to give them $350 billion capital, we could just do that through direct equity injections. Okay, it was a very, very inefficient way of doing it. Secondly, it rewards incompetence. Well, we're leaving the folks who got us there in place. You know, we're buying their bad, we're buying their junk. You know, so you have all these, you know, these executives that basically wrecked their banks and have also wrecked our economy as a side effect. And, you know, we're going to leave them there and just pay too much for their junk. Why do we want to do that? You have people on stock. They're going to be very happy. You know, I was on a show, not immediately with him, but just opposite Warren Buffett. And someone said, well, Warren Buffett favors the bailout. And I go, he just invested $5 billion in Goldman Sachs. Of course he favors the bailout. You know, you're going to help the stockholders. You know, if we had lots of money to go around, sure, help the stockholders. But, you know, that really should not be the priority. You don't want to reward the people who brought us here. And the last point, I mean, it's just incredible. We got very little, almost nothing for homeowners. I mean, we've got, you know, commitments. We'll see what they're worth from Henry Paulson. He's supposed to try to do workouts. We'll see what's done. But, you know, when it came, for example, something that you knew would have an effect, you changed the bankruptcy law so that a bankruptcy judge can treat a home mortgage just like any other debt that comes before them, the credit card debt, the car loan, any other debt, they could reset the terms. They refused to budge on that. That was dropped from the table at the word go, which, again, was kind of strange given that supposedly we had the Great Depression looming there if we didn't pass the bill, that you weren't willing to rewrite the bankruptcy law. Very strange. Okay, so that's a quick take on the bailout. Let me just jump to the sales pitch because I think it really was striking. You know, we saw this incredible uniformity among elite opinion that, you know, we needed this. And it was just kind of remarkable because everyone was absolutely convinced we needed it or we'd have the Great Depression, whereas I'm sure 99% of all those people who knew we needed it or we'd have the Great Depression couldn't begin to tell you why or how. I mean, it was just this amazing, really arrogance and elitism, you know, all the things that my good friend Sarah Palin always talks about. I mean, it was really a witness there because you had people who, you know, all consider themselves very well educated and very well informed who didn't know what they were talking about. You know, and they were absolutely convinced that you had the unwashed masses out there who were going to allow their anger and resentment to prevent the economy from being saved. Well, no, actually, the unwashed masses, although I'm sure they didn't understand the details of the bailout, were exactly right. This was a very poorly designed bailout which would reward the people who got us here. Why should people not be upset about that? You know, it's very hard to tell someone why, you know, a normal person who gets their living working as a truck driver or cleaning toilets should pay higher taxes so that, you know, Henry Paulson's friends at Goldman Sachs could get even more money in their paycheck. I don't know a good argument for that. Maybe someone else does, but I don't. But, you know, anyhow, that's where we were. And it was really remarkable that you had this uniformity. You had people saying things which were absolute nonsense. President Bush got on TV, said we may have a Great Depression. That's the first time I ever heard a politician say that his own policies could bring down the Great. You know, usually you say, you know, the other guy, your policies are, but no, he said, you know, I might give you the Great Depression. I mean, incredible, incredible. I've never seen anything like that. And, you know, we also had, you know, I bring my Washington Post with me. You know, this was the day after, but it, you know, repeats their line throughout. There was no plan B. You know, there was no alternative. You know, if we didn't do this, there was no alternative. Well, could have had direct injections of capital. The United Kingdom just did that. Didn't Henry Paulson know that? Didn't know about the idea? You know, it was done by Sweden back in 92. This was not a mystery. Every economist in the country was talking about it, so there's no plan B. It's never occurred to him. You know, and the other part of the story that, you know, I was really struck by, and I'll confess, I didn't notice, the Fed had the authority to directly buy commercial paper from non-financial corporations. This is a really big story. It's a little techie stuff, but, you know, most major companies, they finance themselves on an ongoing basis by issuing, you know, commercial paper, typically 90-day notes, that banks buy and then resell, or they could hold it, and that's how they get the money to meet their bills, to buy their material, make their paychecks, you know, meet their other bills. Well, that market was freezing up. It was much more expensive, or in some cases altogether impossible for even very sound companies to raise money in the commercial paper market. It's a very, very bad story, you know. So you get a Verizon or some big company that, you know, is fundamentally sound, it's not about to go out of business, they're going to have to lay off workers. What can they do? Very scary story. Well, turns out the Fed had the option, they could just buy the commercial paper themselves. I actually didn't know they had the legal authority to do that. They do have the legal authority to do that. No one mentioned that before the bailout passed. It was after it passed, suddenly the Fed goes out there and what do you know? They're buying up commercial paper of non-financial. That's not very honest. It's not very honest. Let me just mention one other thing in the dishonesty department. Again, carrying my Washington Post with me. Front page of the business section the day after the bill passes, new law seeks to limit executive compensation. And they talked to Grave Crystal, who's a good guy, the leading expert on executive compensation. He said, this won't limit anyone's pay. Okay, why didn't they talk to Grave Crystal the day before the vote? Okay, because we had a lot of people running around there saying, we've cracked down on executive pay. There aren't going to be any more of these big paychecks. Well, that wasn't true. And they could have talked to Grave Crystal and could have told everyone that. The people who were saying that either didn't know what they were talking about or weren't being honest. Take your pick. But they didn't bother to tell us that. They didn't want the unwashed masses to know that. Okay, and, you know, so that wasn't very funny. I'll just leave that one at that and come back to my quick forecast because I'm probably overrunning my time here. Okay, where do I see things going? First and foremost, obviously, the immediate crisis is this financial crisis. Can we keep the system going? I'm actually fairly confident of that. Two reasons. One is, you know, we've discovered more duct tape than I realized. The Fed can buy commercial paper of non-financial corporations. They have a lot of duct tape. You know, that will get them very far. They lowered the federal funds rate that was coordinated with the other major banks in the world. That was a very good thing. They lowered it a half point. They got the ECB to do it, the European Central Bank. I don't know what goes on there. Those people are half crazy, but they still had a 4.25 point interest. You know, the Fed was at 2.25. They had 4.25. Our inflation rate's higher than theirs. I don't know what they think over there. But in any case, they somehow managed to get them to lower their overnight money rate by a half a point. Presumably they'll go further. That's a very, very good sign. Also, from the papers this morning, it now sounds like Henry Paulson is actually thinking of doing, you know, Plan B, the direct injection of capital route. I'm very pleased to hear that. I hope that there's a lot of pressure on him to do that, because basically that is the way you should do it. And, you know, maybe he's letting his concern for the economy overcome his allegiance to his former colleagues at Goldman Sachs and other people on Wall Street. That is very, very good news. If he goes that route, that will be very, very good news. So my expectation is we will get through the immediate financial crisis. There will be more bank failures. There will definitely be a lot of very bad news coming from the financial sector, but we will get through that. Now, we are still going to have a very serious recession, going back to the slide up here. We have to switch from a situation where we had a near zero savings rate to a situation where we have a normal savings rate somewhere around 8% of household income. That's going to be very bad news. And in President Bush's effort to scare people to death, I think he probably did scare people to death, we're probably going to have that change take place very quickly. A lot of the data that we're getting, we don't have that much yet for the last week or two in September since he made his speech, but a lot of the data or anecdotes certainly suggest that people are hugely curtailing their consumption. On the one hand, that's a good thing. People have to do that. You have people in their 50s that don't have a dime to their name at this point. You know, they're going to be totally dependent on their Social Security and their retirement. They have to start saving. They should start saving. It's a good thing they do that. It's not a good thing that they do it all at once. So we're likely to see a recession. We're likely to see a very bad recession. And the question is, how can we have an effective policy response? The immediate issue has to be stimulus. I was glad to see Nancy Pelosi suggesting $150 billion. I've been saying $300 to $400. And that might sound out of line, but last year I was saying $150 when they were saying $75, and 2 weeks later they were saying $150. So we'll see where that goes. That's the immediate story. Over a longer term, we have to correct the trade balance. That means getting the dollar down. And unfortunately, our politicians are scared to say that. But we have to get the dollar down. It's been going the wrong way lately, but we really need to get the dollar down. We could do that unilaterally. We don't have to beg anyone. We could get the dollar down as a matter of policy. Ideally, it would be coordinated, but that front and center has to be the top item over the longer-term agenda to get the dollar down to a level that allows for something close to balanced trade. I mean, I'm not, you don't need a perfectly balanced trade, just like you don't need a perfectly balanced budget. But we should be somewhere close to balanced trade, and we're obviously very far from that today. So I'll stop with that and let Mark go.
Yeah, man, I'm glad that Dean laid out the basics of the crisis here. One of the reasons we decided to have this event is because the IMF, which has been looking for a new mission since the Bretton Woods system collapsed in 1973, that was their original mission, you know, was to, from 1944, was to maintain this system of fixed exchange rate, and that disappeared in 1973, and ever since then they've been looking for other things to do. And so with the onset of the crisis, they've been saying, well, perhaps we should become the new regulator of global finance. And and something to be taken seriously, because they still have a certain amount of clout in the world, although it's greatly diminished, and they could play a very significant role in the near future. So that's so I'm going to look at that aspect of it. And then I want to make a couple of other points that I think are important to the present situation. But so I just organized this with apologies to David Letterman as the top 10 reasons why the IMF shouldn't take the lead in the reform of global finance. And let's start with the first one, number 10. Okay, they missed the two biggest asset bubbles in the history of the world. Now, if you go through, you know, the World Economic Outlook comes out twice a year. And if you go through the last 6 years or 10 years, whatever one, you don't really see much. There was a couple sections they wrote on the stock market bubble and said that that's not really a problem. We're not sure if it really exists. And then they had one issue a few years back where they said a little bit about possible housing bubble, but then never said anything about it again as the bubble continued to explode. Now, Dean already showed you the home prices graph. Here's one for the stock market bubble. So you can see these things were pretty visible. This little thing there, that was 1929, the price-to-earnings ratio, which is a measure of the value of stocks relative to either, you know, to their earnings, either presently or forward or trend. And you can see that they really kind of went off the charts there in the late 90s. And Dean was the first and really the only economist in the U.S. to show arithmetically that these stock prices were not compatible with any plausible projections for growth of the economy, because stock prices are related to economic growth. And so they should have either been able to look at the graph or understand the arithmetic. And I might add that their budget is about, last I looked, although it's being cut now, 1,000 times the size of CPERS. So it's kind of their job to notice these things. What's the world economic outlook if you're going to miss the biggest asset bubbles in the history of the world? Not a good sign. The IMF is unaccountable. My favorite story about that was a chief economist of the IMF was here talking to NGOs a few years ago, and he was getting annoyed, and he said, "I don't understand why all these NGOs are saying we're not accountable. Everything we do, we cleared with Treasury first." Which would be fine, except there's 184 other countries in the organization. Developing countries have no significant say in the IMF decisions. And this has been a movement, as some of the people in the audience know, to try and change this for many years. And they finally had some success. This was the before the reforms. Now, this is a little misleading. I mean, you see the United States with 17% of the vote. First of all, that's enough to veto a lot of major decisions. But second of all, they don't vote in the executive board. Out of 2,000 decisions, when we asked them a few years back that they had made, the executive board had only voted 12 times. So they reach a kind of consensus, and it's a kind of a G1 consensus, as we say in Washington. And that's, you know, it's just, you know, that'd be a long story to explain how that is, but it really is a lot of it's just that's the way the IMF was set up in 1944, and it hasn't really changed. Now, they did change some. You can see this next pie chart. Oh, it looks very similar. The United States lost a half a point, and China, which is the second largest economy in the world, and has, you know, 1.3 billion people, they went from 2.9 to 3.6% in voting shares. And that was the biggest change that was made. And people fought for this for, you know, as far back as I can remember, since I've been in Washington, 10, 15 years. And they, you know, so I figured at this rate, sometime a couple centuries from now, developing countries will have a voice, but hopefully by that time there'll be high-income countries. The IMF is the head of a creditors cartel that has pressured developing countries to adopt harmful policies over the last three decades. We'll look at this a little bit more. And, of course, we could spend a long time discussing this. But just so you know, the basic, the way it has worked, and unfortunately still works in the poorest countries, is that it's not that the IMF itself is such a powerful institution or a huge lender. The power has come from an informal arrangement by which countries have a choice, very often presented with a choice, where if they can agree to the IMF conditions on an IMF agreement, whether it's a short-term or standby arrangement or a longer-term poverty reduction and growth facility. And they can, if they don't agree, very often what has happened is, very, very often, is they wouldn't get the credit from the World Bank or other multilateral institutions or the G7 governments. And in the past, even sometimes the private sector. So that gave them a lot of power to implement policies which haven't turned out all that well. Here's some that didn't turn out all that well. The IMF made a mess in the last set of financial and economic crises, which it, by the way, didn't anticipate either. And so it isn't just the U.S. where they missed the stock market and the housing bubble. And so let's go through a little bit of this. Argentina, let's see. There's the drop in GDP during the recession of 1998 to 2002 in Argentina. Oh, I'm sorry, this is the Asian crisis first. I was going to take Argentina first. There's the drop in Argentina. And it was a huge drop, the worst recession they've had in probably the history of the country. And this was a recession that was brought on by a set and exacerbated by a set of policies that the IMF insisted on and supported. Now, they, you know, in retrospect, they say, well, we didn't tell them what to do, and of course, it's hard to say that. It's hard to believe that when they can't really have it both ways. And you loan them billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars. You sign off on the policy, so you either agreed with them or you're giving them money to do the opposite of what you want. But in any case, the policies were a failure. The fixed exchange rate, the overvalued fixed exchange rate that collapsed, and then they came in. Yeah, that was the kind of the center of the bad policy, and then they just insisted on austerity measures, and then the whole thing collapsed, and the economy collapsed at the end of 2001. And then, you know, here's another failure as an institution. They were supposed to be some kind of lender of last resort. I mean, they were willing to pour in tens of billions of dollars to support this completely inevitable collapse, to support the policy that led to an inevitable collapse. But once the economy collapsed, they didn't really give them anything at all. There was no net, in fact, there was a net drain of about $4 billion out of the country to the IMF and the other international financial institutions, and most of it to the IMF. And that was like 4% of GDP. So they didn't help. They helped create the crisis. They made it worse. They attached a bunch of unpalatable conditions, which the country was smart enough to reject. And look, they got rid of the IMF, and look at the growth they've had. 3 months the economy contracted, and then has grown about 60% since then. And so they were much better off when the IMF finally went away. They had to pay them, unfortunately, $10 billion to go away completely. And they still didn't go away completely, because then there's the Paris Club, you know, which they just now, a couple month or two ago, a few weeks ago, they agreed to pay off the Paris Club. So they really have the IMF have no more influence. Okay, the Asian crisis was another disaster the IMF was heavily involved in. This is an economic crisis. Both of these crises had some similarities with the one that we're facing today, although they're different. And it's nice to know that the Treasury, by the way, is so flexible today in the United States to allow the largest nationalization in the history of the world, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the largest transfer of debt, the nationalization of the largest insurance company, the extending deposit insurance to $3.4 trillion worth of money market mutual fund deposits, which were not previously insured. These were important and necessary things, but not what they told these other countries to do. And that, of course, was a big theme at the 63rd meeting of the General Assembly a couple of weeks ago at the United Nations. You know, people were making jokes, various world leaders, about socialism in the United States and so on. And in these countries, they had a kind of merciless things. And you can see Indonesia had the worst drop and the slowest recovery during the Asian financial crisis. And they were telling them to, first of all, they had raised interest rates, which was rather devastating in the time of recession, especially there where the corporations had a much higher debt-to-equity ratio than in the United States. They were telling them to meet inflation targets, which were impossible considering how far the currencies had fallen. In Indonesia, for example, currency fell by 80%. They were expecting them to hold inflation to 5.2% from 4.2% before the crash of the currency. So they were really giving them policies that were that made the situation worse. I think pretty much most people agree on that now. And you know, it's kind of fascinating. It shows the real power of the media and how different it is when the crisis comes home. Because now you have a front page article in the New York Times today about revisiting the legacy of Alan Greenspan, who supported all this financial deregulation and the proliferation of derivatives that also went all over the world. And still, you know, and now they're saying, well, maybe he wasn't so right after all, so great. And but during the Asian crisis, you can't see this, but it's in the Times, this little Time magazine cover, the Committee to Save the World of Alan Greenspan, Bob Rubin, and Larry Summers. Bob Rubin and Larry Summers being the ones who went out to Asia and set the terms for their for the resolution of that crisis. And you know, it devastated their economies. And what happened? It did somewhat injure the reputation of the IMF, but not the Committee to Save the World, okay? And so now the Committee to Save the World is going to get a little bit of a reevaluation, we hope. But who knows? So that's the Asian and the Argentine crisis. I could go on. I mean, I mentioned Russia in there, but we don't, you know, that one was totally ignored really by the media. That was one of the worst calamities without a natural disaster in the history of the world. They lost about 33% of GDP at least between 92 and 96, 97. And that was, that was another IMF program. So IMF has shown no serious efforts at reform despite repeated failures. I'm happy if there's anybody from the IMF in the audience, which they often do come to these, please tell me that I'm wrong. I would love to hear it. The IMF's economic projections can be way off target and may be politically influenced. Here's a good one. This is Argentina. And all you really have to look at is the column on the right, which has the how far they were off on GDP growth. Now, you notice they were off in the big positive direction when they were managing the recession between 1998 and 2002. These are projections made by the IMF just in the fall of the year before we're talking about. So 1999, they make a projection for 2000. How does it come out? Off by 2.3, off by 8.1, off by 13.5 the next year. Then the Argentina started doing all the things they didn't want. They defaulted on their debt. They took a hard line against the creditors while the IMF was pressuring them to pay more. They froze utility prices. They did all these things the IMF was quite upset about, and that's why they didn't give them any money. Then the IMF seems to be off in the other direction, off by negative 7.8, then 5.0, then 5.2, and 4.3. These are huge errors, okay? So I use their papers a lot, I have to say, their research. I'm not speaking from prejudice here. I would like to see them preserved as a research institution. It's just this is one problem with their forecasting that would have to be corrected. Their economic policies have in general failed. This is, of course, a very hard thing to prove over, you know, overall, econometrically. So one thing that we did was just, well, here's Latin America. You can look at that, a heavily influenced IMF region since the 1980s. That's the graph I always show for, you know, whenever we talk about Latin America. They grew from 82% per capita from 1960 to 1980. And since then, again, the period when the IMF had the most influence on policy overwhelmingly, it's been slow, very slow economic growth, only 9% per capita from 80 to 2000. This decade has picked up quite a bit, especially the last few years, but still not going to be anything like one of the previous decades. And this is the growth they're raving about in the business press. The bar has become so low. They forget that developing countries normally grow faster than rich countries. This growth that they had, you know, in the 60s and 70s was not phenomenal. It was only about half or less than half of what South Korea and Taiwan did during the same period. But it was normal growth. So hopefully this era is coming to an end. And there's been a whole series of elections in at least 10 countries where voters rejected this set of policies and have been pushing for alternatives. Another way to just look at the policies that the IMF has been promoting since 1980 is just to look at the whole world. And I don't want to go on too long here, so I'll just briefly say this is 163 countries divided into quintiles by their income levels. And you can see there were big declines, except for the lowest one, very lowest quintile. But that's India and China and Vietnam. If you take that out, there's nothing to brag about there either. And in fact, it's still pretty bad growth at 1.7% annually. So they can't really, I mean, again, you can't blame the IMF for all this, but I would like to see the IMF come back and say, why is it? They haven't really had to answer this question because nobody's put enough pressure on them. Why has the world economy done so badly, developing countries, I should say, since 1980? It's a long time now. You can't blame it anymore on just the debt pileup from the 70s, like you used to say. You know, they should really, since they were involved in decision-making in dozens of developing countries, heavily involved, they should be able to tell us, is this just, you know, something that, is this an act of God? Is there some reason for this? And I haven't heard it yet. The IMF has been a champion of the deregulated global finance flows that played a huge role in the current mess. And they did that, in fact, in the Asian crisis. That was one of the causes of the Asian financial crisis. I would say the primary cause was the deregulated finance that the IMF and Treasury together pushed on countries like South Korea and Indonesia, got them to remove a lot of their restrictions on both financial and non-financial corporations, restrictions on foreign borrowing, regulation of foreign borrowing that they had. And it was that hot money flow that went in and then out that really played the biggest role in creating that mess. And of course, they have supported the kind of globalization of finance that has contributed to the mess that we're looking at today. And you know, at the end of the Asian crisis, they actually wanted to change their, that was the beginning of the crisis, they changed it afterwards. They wanted to change their charter so that they could actually pressure countries to open up to capital inflows. So, what's number one? I know the suspense is killing you. The IMF is run mostly by the U.S. Treasury Department. There he is. 164 million at the peak of the housing bubble while Goldman Sachs was being run into the ground and the financial sector going down with it. And this, by the way, the fact that the U.S. Treasury mostly runs the IMF is not really a matter of dispute here in Washington. I mean, if you talk to the IMF officially, they'll tell you that we're a 185-member organization, et cetera, et cetera. But as I said, the U.S. influence is much, much greater than even the formal veto power that they have. Do I have a couple minutes still? Yeah, I think I have a couple. All right. I want to make a couple of points because After the Asian crisis especially, there was a lot of talk about a new financial architecture, and there were books written and policies proposed, and some of them were good ideas, world currency, a world central bank, all kinds of things that seemed kind of utopian perhaps, but they were taken seriously at the time, because at that time that was a pretty serious crisis. They didn't know what was coming. And so what happened 10 years later? Nothing. Right? Did you see anything happen? Has there been a change in the financial architecture? No. In fact, it got worse, right? The U.S. Financial sector managed to come up with toxic securities that caused trouble all over the world. And so it didn't happen. And I would argue that it's not going to happen. And that we shouldn't, it's fine with me if people want to talk about it. I'm all for vision. But I think we should also try to be realistic. And I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding of the world economy that leads people to think that this problem, these problems are going to be resolved at the global level. That is, that the rich countries, and now, you know, Zolich says we got to get some of our favorite developing countries into the G8, so that it's not just the rich countries, that there's going to be a formal organization like the IMF or something perhaps to be created that's going to resolve these problems. I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's a misunderstanding of the economy. I don't think we really have a global economy. I think we have a collection of national economies still, even today. And, you know, the vast majority of what's produced in the world is still consumed locally. And finance is even still, despite all the changes, even more national than international. And so it's going to be national solutions and regional ones, like the Chiang Mai Initiative in Asia, for example. And they're talking about regional solutions in Latin America now. And the reason is this, okay? These people haven't changed. I'm sorry to say that they were very flexible in the latest response to the crisis here, and I'm glad that they were, and I hope they continue to show flexibility, even if they did have that horrible bailout thing for their friends. The other measures that we've mentioned were the important and necessary ones, and there's going to be a lot more that are necessary. But when it comes to the developing world, the rich countries just don't have their interests at heart. And that's one reason why you wouldn't want not only the IMF, but something else to be the dominant institution here. So I think you will see more coordination. I hope you'll see more coordination. The G7, obviously the interest rate cuts, coordinating that was a very positive step. Maybe they'll have coordination on exchange rate policy. We could always hope for that. But the idea of a new system coming out of this isn't going to happen. And national policy, I just want to emphasize how important it is. Look at China during the Asian financial crisis. They were the only one of those countries that didn't suffer, that didn't drop and have a big GDP loss. They continued growing quite rapidly. Why? They changed their policies, their macroeconomic policies, and their overall economic policies completely. They focused on inward-oriented growth during that period. They did not get into competitive devaluations and try to get out of the crisis the way the other countries did, and they didn't have the IMF telling them what to do. So individual macro policy is going to be extremely important. I would like to see it coordinated, but the United States, what the United States does with its own macro policy, if they can be as flexible on fiscal policy and get rid of the dogma the way they just have in terms of the nationalizing these major institutions and intervening in the banking system, then we have a chance at mitigating the damage of this recession. But individual countries are going to have to do that and coordinate as much as possible. I don't think it's going to come from any kind of new financial architecture in the foreseeable future. Thanks. Yeah, sure.
Thank you so much. Mark and Dean. Before we go into questions, I just wanted to make one small comment, which is that all of this discussion is bringing up for me the fact that this summer we actually were in danger of having this model actually increasingly codified of deregulation of the financial sector through the WTO negotiations. And you all know that there are in the WTO negotiations on industrial tariffs, agriculture, and the third pillar is in services. And within the services negotiations, the major goal of the United States is to get more countries to agree to put their financial services sectors under discipline of WTO, which means preventing them from being able to implement the type of policies that we're talking about today to deal with the financial crisis. They're talking about within the WTO if they would subject their financial services sectors, then being prevented from implementing those policies. And because the negotiations failed to conclude this summer in Geneva, obviously we're still fighting that. They're still trying to expand the WTO, but because they failed this summer, we're not faced with that problem of having some of that policy space curtailed so that countries still have that ability to do so. So with that additional caution, I'd like to open it up for questions. Please. We are actually recording this, and it will be available on the web afterwards. And so if you could please use the mic also, which Becky will be handing out. Thank you.
I would like to reinterpret the word failure. If you say failure, is the reference is helping the developing countries, but they didn't failure recovering the investments of these creditor cartels. There was a big transfer of money from developing countries to most developed countries. So in this sense, was not a failure. So to interpret failure is always a reference to some fixed point.
No, I think that's true partly. I mean, they sure didn't recover it in Argentina. They defaulted on $100 billion of debt and paid about a third of it. So and they did, though, they recovered more of it in Asia. And it does, of course, depend on your goals, what you consider failure. I was looking at it from the point of view of development and the interests of the majority.
Hi, just two quick questions. Dean, you were talking about a stimulus package, and I was wondering if you could define what you meant as opposed to what one would hear from other sources who have other interests at heart. And secondly, do you think that there's any opportunity now for any kind of structural changes that could advance economic democracy in the country at all? And the quick question for you, Mark, it might be interesting to just share a little bit about how the globalization of finance has contributed to the mess we're in now, if you don't mind. Thank you so much.
Okay, structure, stimulus, I mean, you know, you still want to, I was on a panel yesterday, I said, you know, usually the concern with stimulus is can you spend money quickly, and, you know, one advantage we have this time is we're likely to be faced with a long recession, so we don't have to worry so much about that. But you still, I mean, the idea is what can you do reasonably quickly? Well, a few things. One is get money to state and local governments. So the Post just had an article today about how Virginia's planning all these big cutbacks. Everyone is across the country. They all have very constrained state and local governments. They're going to be laying off workers, cutting back services. You don't want to see that in the middle of a downturn, so get a lot of money to state and local governments. They don't have to do that. Secondly, you know, a lot of infrastructure programs, projects that have been put on hold or are sitting on the shelf, you could bring those forward. But the most important thing I'd like to see done is to really try and promote a green stimulus to try to, you know, do something that will have a lasting benefit. So there's a lot of things we could do. The most obvious thing are retrofitting buildings to make them more energy efficient, promote public transit. There's a lot of things we could do like that that would have real lasting benefits and money that could be spent quickly. So, you know, that's the direction I'd like to see us go with that. And again, I think we really have to talk about big numbers. I know it sounds scary to people, say $300 or $400 billion, but, you know, we're looking at a serious downturn, so I do think we have to talk about numbers like that. The second question, economic democracy, boy, I sure hope we could do something. I mean, it was remarkable to me. Some of you may have caught this. The front page of the New York Times is about two Sundays ago. There's an article talking about when Paulson made the decision to rescue AIG, keep them from going under. He had the current CEO, you know, of course, he's the former CEO of Goldman Sachs. They had the current CEO of Goldman Sachs in the room at the time. The reason why that matters is AIG owed Goldman Sachs $20 billion. Now, maybe there's nothing improper. Maybe Henry Paulson made the exact same decision, but that really stinks. I mean, you got the guy who stands to lose $20 billion in the room with you going, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's, you know, that's not the way decisions should be made. So if we could do something to, you know, kind of open up the process. I mean, one of my pet things, just an easy and I think obvious thing is, you know, why do they have a special say in the Federal Reserve Board policy? I mean, it's absolutely crazy. I won't go into details here, but basically, if 12 people decide monetary policy, the monetary policy of the United States conducted by the Federal Reserve Board, I should say 12 people voting, you have at any point in time 19 people in the room. 12 of those 19 are basically appointed by the banks. 5 of the 7 people voting are basically appointed by the banks. I can't understand any rationale for that. You know, they're concerned about monetary policy, so are we all. They don't have any special interest in it.
Yeah, that's a very important point in terms of democratization. And it would be it seems like a small reform, but it would take a big fight to get that. In terms of the globalization of finance, I think one way, of course, that the globalization of finance has affected the current crisis is the spread of these bad mortgage-backed securities and other derivatives, especially the huge credit default swap market around the world. I think certainly that's one element in terms of globalizing the problem. The other aspect of it, I think, if you go back, you know, even to the 90s in some a lot of countries, Brazil, for example, they had capital controls, and it was much easier for countries to deal with a crisis like this. So because finance is globalized and these have been removed, it's harder. You see countries find that their country risk, which is their basically the interest rate spread on their bonds, goes up in a time like this, even if they haven't necessarily done anything wrong. And they become vulnerable to some degree. Now, so far, it hasn't been that bad, but that part of it could get worse.
Thank you. All the news this morning was, as you had mentioned, about on all the wires about the Treasury considering an equity infusion in banks. I guess considering. Doesn't mean that they will be doing it. So my first question would be to you whether that's going to happen and what scale that would happen and what that really means. I lived in France when a new socialist government came to place and the first thing they did, they began nationalizing the entire financial banking sector. Not because there was a crisis, but I guess that's a socialist thing to do. And I think 6 months later, they said, no, sorry, we're going to denationalize now. It didn't really work. So what does that mean if this is going to happen? That the government may be maybe one of the largest, if not the largest, equity holder of the financial sector or the banking sector. Does that mean that I am, you know, all you citizens are going to be, you know, shareholders, be on the boards, or, you know, so what does that mean long term? If it's going to happen, what's the scale of that? What does that mean to our understanding of the financial sector?
Okay, very good questions. First off, will it happen? I don't have any special insight. I mean, I'm reading tea leaves like anyone else. I was on a panel yesterday with a former Bush Treasury official, and he was very confident that were going to be direct equity injections, and I don't know whether that was from conversations he'd recently had with Paulson or other people there, just his general reading of the leaves from someone who's on the inside, but he seemed to think that was going to happen. The other reason why I think it is likely it's going to happen at this point is obviously the Treasury wants, you know, this wasn't, you know, they've let this out. They've been talking about it, and it would seem a strange thing to do to raise the issue and then not do it. So it seems to me that they probably wouldn't be talking about it unless they actually do plan to do it. I mean, I could be wrong in that, but that's just my thinking on it. So I don't have any special insight, but my thinking is that they will do it. I don't know whether that means they'll take the whole $700 billion and use that for equity injections, or maybe they'll do that selectively. You know, I really couldn't answer that. I'm just guessing here. So, my guess is that they probably would do it at least selectively and see what the response was. In any case, it is striking that, more than a week after the bailout, or a week after the bailout passed, and they had obviously anticipated passing, we still don't have any information about the auction scheme. So if they're going to go the other route, for whatever reason, they're rather slow on it. Remember, it was going to be the end of the world if it didn't pass, and now it's already a week later, and they haven't even outlined, the timetable for when the first auction is going to be, what are the rules. It's kind of strange, given it was the end of the world last week. So my guess is they're going the route, they will go at least partially the route of equity purchases. Now, what does that mean? My view, I'm not really anxious to have the government run the banks, but, we're taking the banks over because they were run poorly. The people who were running them didn't know what they were doing, and they drove them into bankruptcy. So it's to my mind, not out of an ideological desire to get control of the banks. It's that we have people there running them who have to be replaced. What does the government do when it takes over? Well, in England, they immediately eliminated dividends. They replaced some of the management, knocked down the pay of others. I would expect you to do that. But, what I would expect would happen is that the government would look to stabilize the financial system, get the balance sheets in order, and sell off their interest. And the time frame there, presumably 2, 3, 4 years, maybe it'll be a little longer. But, again, the intention isn't, at least to my mind, I'm sure it's not the Bush administration's intention, but thankfully they won't be here for 3, 4, 5 years, is to straighten things out and sell them off, so that would be my expectation. But, you're absolutely right. You get in a situation, the government's allocating capital like crazy now. The Federal Reserve Board, when they're buying the commercial paper of private companies, has to decide whose paper they're going to buy. So presumably, if you have a Verizon, or not that I'm a big fan of Verizon, lots of reasons I might not like them, but in any case, they're going to be in business. So, you can say, okay, Verizon's safe, but, when United Airlines comes to you, I don't know. Maybe United's safe too. I'm not saying necessarily going to go out of business, but we can give a list, and some of those companies on that list are not going to be safe. So is the Fed going to decide to give them credit or not? You can't avoid that.
Thank you. My name is Dominic. I used to work for the World Bank, not for the IMF. But I have a question on that. The first one for Dean, and it's related to the last question. It can happen that in a few years from now, when we are again out of the recession, maybe 4 or 5 years, I don't know how long, maybe you have forecasts for that. Or even earlier, the government, the Congress decide to pass some regulation, and then they said, now we can put the banks again in private hands, because now we have passed some regulation, whether good, sufficient or not, but just a bit, so they can come back to ownership of the banks. So wouldn't that be reversing the whole idea of basically putting these institutions, or some of them, in hands that are not just looking for profit maximization? Because in the end, even if you put some regulation on it, if that's the bottom line, there are always ways to move around regulation. No? That would be the question for you. And for Mark, it's very interesting what you showed about Latin America and how the different growth performance before 1980 and after 1980. And when I talk about, and I always make this point, I borrow that from you, with my neoliberal friends. I have some neoliberal friends. And I need a rebuttal now, because they always say, okay, that's right, but you don't know the counterfactual. It could have gotten worse with the old policies. Now, that sounds like a joke, and I say, okay, I guess I'm not a counterfactual economist, but they all seem very serious when they say it, and apparently I'm missing something, no? So I don't know if you can comment on that. Thank you.
Let me just quickly speak to counterfactuals. I mean, obviously the bailout went through, but obviously, I was in the middle of talking with people who were fighting to try and stop it. And, you go back to last Monday when the stock market plunged when the bailout was originally voted down, and that was immediately used as a piece of ammunition. These know-nothings just cost us $1 trillion in stock wealth. I mean, by the way, I should say, if you ever hear anyone arguing for the merits or demerits of a policy based on stock wealth, you either know that, you know, that person's either a liar or doesn't know what they're talking about, so ask them which it is. But in any case, you know that was the argument. And you know, consider what has happened since the bailout passed. The stock market plunged. Imagine the bailout had gone down. So that's our counterfactual. Suppose we had the exact same response in the stock market that we've had since Thursday, but the bailout had gone down. What do you think would have happened to those members of Congress who voted against it?
And the credit markets, too.
Yeah, the credit markets didn't clear up either. I mean, so if you'd had the exact same, you know, they'd have been crucified. It just shows you the, you know, the really the horrible, horrible media coverage of this, that none of them bothered to point that out. I mean, the incredible double standard. But getting your question, I'm not a big fan. I don't think there's anything obvious to be gained by having the government own a large chunk of the financial system. I mean, I think, you know, the Fed obviously plays a very big role, should continue to play a big role. We need better regulation. I mean, there's a conscious decision to let these guys run wild. You know, they let, you know, Goldman Sachs leverage itself 30-1. I mean, it's just kind of mind-boggling. You know, I didn't follow some of these regulatory changes that close. I didn't know that. I mean, I knew they were getting more leverage. I didn't know that much. You go 30-1, you lose 3%. 3% of your loans go bad and you're bankrupt? I mean, it's just kind of astounding. Like, what on earth is going through their heads? You know, so we need serious regulation, and it wasn't a hard thing to do. It was that you had regulators that weren't committed to it. And, you know, obviously that was true in the Bush administration. I'll be bipartisan here. A lot of this began under Clinton, of course, so Clinton's people were no better. It got worse under Bush. But in any case, Clinton's people were no better. And, you know, insofar as Congress had oversight, they were, you know, happy to look the other way, you know, and that would, but, you know, if suppose Goldman Sachs were owned by the government, you know, you could still have plenty of people doing inappropriate things if no one's committed to watching them, and that really was the problem.
Let me just quickly answer the argument on the counterfactual, because they do make this occasionally, and not publicly so much. You know, you can never prove the counterfactual. So, of course, it's always possible that they would have done even worse since 1980. But you're still, the problem with that argument is you can still use the pre-1980 period as a benchmark, okay? So if they're going to say, so this was clearly the pre-1980 growth was possible. And as I said, it was only half of what, you know, South Korea and Taiwan did. So they still don't get out of it. They, you know, sure, maybe some of the policies had to change, right? Countries always change as they reach a different stage of development or something changes in the world, they have to change their policies. So they still made the wrong change, okay? Because they made a change to policies that lead to very little growth and a lot of poverty, whereas they could have made, conceivably, they should be smart enough to recommend policies that at least give you the kind of growth you had in the past, even if it's not the same exact policies.
You mentioned about deregulation, regulations. I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on what might be one or two or three regulations that will be at the top of the list for you. And sometimes I just wonder, I mean, if the others, these folks are smarter than regulators in some cases.
Well, first, one of the things that has come out of this, I'll be interested to see how far it goes, is I'd love to see a financial transactions tax that actually was discussed seriously. And this is something I've been working on for, you know, God knows how long, 15, 16, 17 years. And usually, you know, you have a few more progressive members of Congress, you know, Bernie Sanders or someone is willing to talk about it. You had Nancy Pelosi talking about it. I mean, you had Charles Schumer. I'm not saying they're necessarily endorsing it, but they were talking about, like, they treat it as a serious policy. I'd love to see that. I mean, you have it in England, so it's not like a crazy thing. You know, they have a modest 0.25% tax on a purchase or sale of a share of stock. If you had a comparable tax on, you know, futures, other derivative instruments, a much smaller scale, say 0.02%, 0.02%, 0.02%, this won't affect real transactions. Someone's looking to hold stock for 5 years or 10, you know, they won't like to pay the tax, but it's not going to affect them if they have to pay a 0.25% tax on the purchase or sale. And it raises an enormous amount of money. I did a paper a few years back, and we estimated that even assuming sharp fall off in trade transactions, you'd still raise on the order of $150 billion a year. So this is real money, you know. So you could get a lot of money, and you reduce transactions all to the good. You know, will it stabilize the markets? wouldn't expect to have a huge effect. It might have some positive effect that way. I don't think it would be negative. And you raise a lot of money by getting rid of wasteful transactions. Other things, you know, obviously with this huge unregulated system of credit default swaps, other derivative instruments, get them on exchanges, standardize them, get them regulated. That really has to be front and center. It's just unbelievable. This was totally foreseeable, by the way. A friend of mine, Jane DeRista, I remember first talking about this, 1992. You know, I mean, this is just outrageous. You know, this idea, you know, I just love these people. You know, I joke about how the motto in this town should be, who could have known? You know, I mean, you know, because this is totally knowable, totally, you know, what, you know, how it would happen, the date, you know, that Bear Stearns, you know, Lehman, we couldn't know that. But, you know, the basic story was totally predictable. The only questions were the people and the time. So those are my top two.
Well, a couple of things. One, you know, it's so politicized when you go to these hearings on the Hill, it's hard to know what's real and what's around the elections. Like, the way the Republicans are trying to pin it on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and how much of that is real. Latest thing that McCain has put out around the foreclosures, how do you respond to that? And this AIG bailout that they've already spent, $61 billion, what does that mean? And they're asking for more. And all of this is really part of, you know, what should we as activists also be focusing on? You've mentioned some of the things like the financial transactions tax, and how much sense does it make to call for Paulson to be fired? He's not going to be there that much longer, but he is sort of the poster child for a lot of this mess. So what other things would you say that activists could focus on?
Okay, give me a full plate. Let me start with the Fannie and Freddie, because this is really just an outrageous twist on things. Because, you know, basically these people are, there should be no ambiguity. This was Wall Street run amok. You know, this was, you know, this happened because, you know, Goldman Sachs, you know, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, incredibly rich, powerful people, didn't know what they were doing, or did and didn't care, because, you know, like Henry Paulson, they made their hundreds of millions, and, you know, whatever happens to their firm, they're going to be home free and incredibly wealthy for the rest of their lives. I don't know. I mean, they could tell us that, but I don't know. But in any case, that was the core story. And they flipped this around, and it really was just kind of racist, because they flip it around, and I'm being serious, I don't use that word lightly. They're trying to say, how can we blame this on blacks and liberals? So Fannie and Freddie and the Community Reinvestment Act. And you're just going, what on earth are you talking about? Fannie and Freddie, I've criticized them. I was out there in 02, 03, 04. I first wrote that they were going to be in problems when this bubble burst in 02. So I've been very critical of them. I continue to be very critical of them. But the idea that they somehow caused this is nuts. I mean, they jumped in on this. They were followers, not leaders. And we go back, we found Moody's, I think it was Moody's, is one of the analysts talking about Freddie's financial situation, and said, well, we'd be concerned because they're losing market share. This was, I believe, in 05, but they're going to get into the Alt-A market, into these more risky loans. That's going to boost them. They were followers. They, you know, Citigroup, you know, the other big ones were the leaders here. So they played a role in it, absolutely. They're big actors that contribute to it. What you would have loved to have seen is, you know, as quasi-public institutions, they'd say, hey, wait, this is getting out of line. There's a bubble. We're not going to do it. Instead of having looser standards, we're going to have tighter standards, 20% down in these bubble markets. We're tightening up. This is crazy. And if they'd done that, that would have had a huge impact. Can you imagine if the head of Fannie or Freddie had gotten up and said, hey, this is it. This is crazy. This is our policy. That would have had a huge impact. But people in the city don't do those things. You know, but, you know, they could be blamed for not being heroes, but, you know, they were followers, not leaders, you know, so the idea that they somehow were the culprits here, the big culprits here, they got what they deserved. I have no sympathy for those guys, and, you know, but they were the followers. And the Community Reinvestment Act, I mean, people should just realize, anyone who's saying this, Community Reinvestment Act's on the books since 1977, okay, it's, I wouldn't say toothless, but it has very vague commitments. And it was never very strongly enforced. It surely was not strongly enforced by the Bush administration. And most of the big institutions that were making subprime loans, the ones that are really out there, you know, the Countrywides, the First National, they were not even covered by the Community Reinvestment Act. And, you know, the final point on that, it's just like utterly absurd. We think the government bureaucrats had to twist the arms of these bankers to make money hand over fist. I mean, it's just crazy. They were making, you know, these companies were making money like crazy on these loans. So the idea that a Community Reinvestment Act, not a single one of these loans is making. They probably, half the bankers probably even know about it, you know. It's just crazy. McCain's $300 billion, I don't know where he came up with this. It's like one of the most harebrained schemes. Basically, when McCain said he picked the number $300 billion, but if he actually wants to have this program, you know, they're going to have like a race because you're going to have, you know, like $2 trillion to mortgages. What he's saying is we're going to buy up these bad loans at their face value. So you've got all these loans that, you know, the house, they made a loan for, you know, $400,000. That house today, it's worth $250,000. John McCain wants to give the bank $400,000 for the loan. I mean, why on earth you would do that? And they said, we're going to be nice to the homeowners. Now, what that means, I don't know. But, you know, in any case, this is an unbelievable handout to the banks. I mean, you know, so there's trillions of dollars in mortgages like that. So if he said $300 billion, I mean, we'll have the race of a lifetime. I mean, they'll be beating each other over the head to be first in line to get that $300 billion. You know, so under the idea that, you know, the rules of the game haven't changed and we still have limits on the money we can give out to people, you know, this is kind of a harebrained scheme. The AIG, I can't tell you. I mean, it's amazing for people who didn't follow it. You know, originally put up $85 billion to, you know, keep the bank alive, the insurance company alive, and now they're getting another $35 billion from the Fed. You know, I'm hoping that's just a liquidity issue. They might have had some money tied up and they need, you know, more to stay liquid. But I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, it's really scary. I mean, it's a very big company, but that's, we're going to see a lot more. So, you know, if we already air out, you know, $120 billion or there, you know, they're about, that's kind of scary. The last point, I mean, you know, what do we do? I mean, there's lots of things to do. I mean, one of the things I just find striking is say, how about someone take responsibility? You know, this is, you know, that seems to be the thing that people are most allergic to in this town is ever taking responsibility. And it's really rude to sort of point out Henry Paulson, okay, he was at Goldman Sachs. He profited from this. He advocated, you know, weakening the restrictions on leverage so that they could get leverage to the hilt like this. You know, he played that role at Goldman Sachs. But in his reign as Treasury Secretary, he said, well, there's no problem with the housing bubble. You know, there is no housing bubble. Then when we first start to see problems, oh, we could contain that. He's been wrong every step along the way. So it's, you know, I have no vendetta against Henry Paulson, but the idea that, you know, people should be held responsible, held accountable, you know, that seems so alien in this town. You know, I think in most governments, this guy would be out of a job. It's just, you know, simply because you messed up on your job, you know, but somehow that doesn't work here. You know, again, striking as an economist, because economists think it's really important to be able to fire people who don't do their jobs, but usually they're talking about the people who clean the toilets, not the people who run the economy.
I think we have time for just one more.
Yeah, thanks. This is related to the activities question, but it's about activities and entities. And you mentioned democratization of the Federal Reserve Board. And I'm wondering, given your perspective that this is not a global economy, but national economies that are most important here, what other entities would you say are that like the top five entities in this existing financial architecture that deserve the most attention with respect to transparency and democratization and that sort of thing? Does that make sense?
You can go ahead. You want? I mean, the Fed, Treasury. What do you? Go ahead.
WTO.
Yeah, why don't you start with the domestic ones?
Okay. Well, the Fed stands front center. Fed's just incredibly important, and most people have no idea what it is. I mean, I got a big kick out of, you know, Alan Greenspan got to be sort of a rock star. They announced he was at the Nationals game, and everyone got up and applaud. And, you know, I'm sure most of these people have no idea what the guy does. He's a guy who keeps the economy working, you know. The Fed has to really be front center as a domestic institution that needs democratization. And, you know, again, people should understand they're our central bank and they have to be answerable. And it really is striking, just to say one more word on that. You know, people think it's like bizarre that Congress would, you know, intervene or, you know, hold the Fed accountable. You know, people say, well, we don't want politicians running monetary policy. Well, I don't want, you know, Congress setting the interest rate today, and, you know, I don't want that. But the people who do set the interest rate absolutely have to be accountable to Congress. Why did you do this? You know, why didn't you do that? You know, that's not intervening. That's their obligation. They have to do that. And, you know, we need people in Congress who are going to take that responsibility seriously.
Yeah, I just want to elaborate that a little bit because there has been this. It's part of the standard economic wisdom that central banks should be independent, and when they say that, they really mean independent of the people because they're not obviously independent of the banking sector, as Dean just described. And that's very important because the banks do have a different interest. You know, big creditors don't really care so much about economic growth or employment. They care much more about inflation. So there's a trade-off, and they're going to always press for policies that would be less inflationary. Even they'll make a trade-off a lot different than you or I would. You know, we'd take another half point of inflation to get 4 million more jobs, whereas they wouldn't. And so it's very bad for the in any country for the financial sector to be running the central bank. And the argument that economists make is a very elitist argument. It's very straightforward. They just say monetary policy is too important to be left to democratic input. Well, they're all a little bit of input, but they really don't. I mean, it's kind of silly. I mean, Congress votes on fiscal policy, right? So why shouldn't they have a say, a very important one, on the, you know, why shouldn't the people who make the other most important economic policy decisions be accountable? The other thing I just want to get back to, you know, in terms of a policy change, and the Dean was emphasizing the beginning, the exchange rate problem, the dollar. I want to emphasize that too, because that's a place where people are going to have to do a lot of educational work. Most people here still think it's a bad thing when the dollar falls. And in fact, you know, it's very odd because in most of the world, you know, in China and Japan and, you know, Indonesia and Argentina and many other countries, it's very well known that the exchange rate is a very important policy variable. And in Europe, too, actually, you know, people get upset when the euro gets too high. I mean, the industrial sector, for example, complains and makes a certain amount of noise in India. And here it just doesn't, you know, the power of the financial sector is so strong because they don't care, right? They want a high dollar, is just means somewhat lower inflation. That's all they care about. And the rest of the society is so unrepresented politically that they can maintain a high dollar policy for years and even pretend like it's a good thing, even as it's creating this fundamental imbalance in our economy, which, as Dean explained, is the reason we've had been dependent on asset bubble-driven consumption for most of the last 15 years. So that's going to have to change, and that's going to be a big job.
Well, thank you. I think we actually need to close right now. I just want to remind all of you all this weekend are the annual meetings of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, and there are a lot of other great events talking about these institutions here. You're going to continue to hear calls from Dominique Strauss-Kahn and others, advocates of the system, for them to be actively involved in resolving this situation, and I hope that from today's discussion you feel better armed to be able to come back with some retorts as to why this is a bad idea. So we thank you very much for coming and look forward to working with you all as we deal with the financial crisis, but also with the coming bigger crisis of the recession. Millions more people will lose their homes in this country, and the middle class will become impoverished because of these policies. And I just want to thanks very much for all of you to coming, and also for Mark and Dean for continuing to be two of the people who really let the rest of us know what's happening in the world so that we can try to fight this. Thank you very much.